Blog Talk Radio.
This is JJ Bomber. You are listening to Well Armed Radio.
Good evening, sheepdogs. Welcome to Well Armed Radio, where freedom is our best friend. Thank you for joining us in our weekly vigorous, relentless, and once in a while ruthless pursuit of freedom. We are broadcasting live from the extraordinarily well-armed studio in New Berlin, Wisconsin. It's my pleasure to speak with the most informed gun owners in the state. That would be you guys. You are your community's finest. With a face for radio and a voice for silent movies, my name is Nick Clark. I'm the president of Wisconsin Carry and host of Well Armed Radio, and encourage you to be a part of the show if you so choose. With your calls, ideas, questions, comments, criticism, participations, welcome at 563-999-3787. Again, that's 563-999-3787. Start the show with our usual warning, no sacred cows here. And as always, we'll do the first 50 minutes of the show open line, but we are mostly podcast listeners here, so not a lot of live. But we do have a couple. We've got Lon here live tonight. Lon, great to see you. Great to have you in. And Lon from the, I guess it's actually the central part of the state. I always felt like the Wausau area was up north because I've got I've got relatives that live in Wausau, and we used to go there a lot. And for us, coming from where I grew up in Delavan, it was always up north. Wausau was up north. Although up north was always Boulder Junction. My grandparents had a cabin in Boulder Junction. But I say up north, but Wausau is really actually, I guess, the central part of the state. So although here in Wisconsin, up north is pretty much any place north of like, I would say any place north of Dells, any place north of, see, like Door County doesn't count as up north. Door County is just Door County. So you got to get, if you're north of Door County, which then you couldn't be on the peninsula, you'd have to be on the, you know, the west side of Green Bay. If you're north of the Dells, that all counts as up north to me. but true up north is like, I don't know, I feel like true up north, you got to get to like Tomahawk and north. North of Tomahawk. I used to love when we'd go up there as a kid to my grandparents' cabin on Man Lake in Boulder Junction. And just when as soon as you're north of Tomahawk, you get out, maybe you stop for gas or something, stretch your legs, or sometimes we would just be driving all the way. And the first time we'd stop would be when we got to the cabin. But you get out of the car and you just take a deep breath in and smell that northern Wisconsin pine. And it's just that's heaven up there. And then the other thing that I remember was just the unbelievable amount of stars. I remember we'd always, get up to the cab, to the cottage, as my family referred to it, late after dark, and you look up in the sky. And so I'm thinking if, maybe my stepdad used to get off work, maybe 4:35, leave 5-ish. I think it's 5 hours to get up to Boulder Junction. So that would put you at like 10 p.m. So you'd walk out on the pier of the, and that was kind of the cool part, was like when we were really little, we'd get up there and it was late. So they'd shuffle us right inside. You really couldn't even see the lake. It was very, very dark. If it wasn't a full moon night, you really couldn't even see the lake. Maybe if the moon was out, you'd see the moon, moon beam across the lake, but you really couldn't get a look at the lake. And I used to just love going up to the cottage, love fishing, and, then wake up in the morning, and then as soon as your eyes wake up, and that's that, especially when you're a kid, that you wake up and you forget where you are, and then you realize, oh my God, I'm up north. And then you look out the window. We used to sleep on the porch of the cottage, which was a converted porch. It was a three-season porch. So we'd sleep on the porch of the cottage usually and look out the window, and there's the lake. And then I'm just waiting for my parents, my stepdad or whoever, to get up so I could get out there and start fishing all day long. But yeah, just anyway, all that, talking about Wausau. And Lon, welcome to the show. So here's what we got tonight. So first thing I was going to say here was I was contacted this week by an individual who I'm not going to identify. It's a person who was referred to me by someone else who I'll just term as a very prominent political figure in Wisconsin. And I thought it was an interesting conversation, so I figured I'd share it with you guys. But here was the question that was posed to me. It said, I am trying to get an exact answer on whether people, this person said how they were referred to me. And then this person went on to say, I'm trying to get an exact answer on whether people with felonies can own and carry non-lethal guns like Byrna. Any assistance would be great. Thank you. And then this person signed their name. Now, here's what's interesting here is, so it's a great conversation for a number of reasons. Maybe first I'm going to share my reply because I think it's something interesting, but there's a little caveat here is that when they say, I'm trying to get an exact answer on whether people with felonies can carry and own non-lethal guns, felons can actually carry lethal guns. And I'll explain that in a minute. But certainly this is this conversation about Byrna. I'd never actually heard of Byrna. And then when I went and researched it, I'm like, oh, that's kind of a cool looking concept. We'll talk about that later in the show as well. So this was my reply to this individual. And I thought it was worth sharing because it kind of raises a few interesting topics. So I said, hey, so-and-so, first disclaimer, I'm not an attorney and this is not legal advice. I'm an expert on Wisconsin's gun laws. So I share this as my understanding of the law and my conclusions, not legal advice. Secondly, I love this topic as I don't believe a felon who has served their sentence should have to give up their ability to protect themselves using a firearm. You shouldn't lose an effective means to exercise your right to self-defense just because you have a felony. Self-defense is a human right. In Wisconsin, a firearm means a weapon that propels a projectile with gunpowder. An air gun does not use gunpowder and is not considered a firearm in Wisconsin. Then I cited the statute that lists that. Felons are allowed to own and possess air guns in Wisconsin. Some states, like Minnesota, used to prohibit felons from possessing air guns, but even that changed in 2016. And this is where, you know, I don't know if it's, you know, whether you're getting old or you've been around for a while, but how some of these things change. I'm interjecting to my email response to this person here, because I remember back in the 2000s when we started open carrying, there was a lot of conversation. 2010, there was a lot of conversation about air guns. And at the time, someone had mentioned that in Wisconsin, an air gun is not considered a firearm. But in Minnesota at the time, an air gun was considered a firearm. So in Minnesota, back in 2010, 2011, 2012, I remember these conversations coming up. And it was like, yeah, a felon in Wisconsin can own, because there's others. I think there's some air guns, and this is when we talk about non-lethal or lethal. I think they're called Bulldog. I feel like Bullpup, maybe. I'm totally going for off the top of my memory. I should have researched it a little bit. But there's some high-powered air guns. I believe there's air guns that shoot 45 caliber bullets. And so you have to, I think it's more of a one-shot deal for most of those. But these high-powered air guns could certainly be lethal. So you don't, a felon is allowed to carry lethal weapons, just not firearms. So if you wanted to carry one of those, again, I think it was called the Bullpup, or a Bulldog doesn't seem right now. I think maybe it was called Bullpup or something, but it's this high powered 45 caliber air rifles is one of the ones that I was thinking of. And there's others. I mean, I've got an Air Force air gun. It shoots, I think it's a 25 caliber pellet. And I would say, it's lethal. I mean, certainly it's lethal for animals. I mean, you can hunt with it, but I don't know if a human being, a headshot with a 25 caliber, I mean, certainly if you hit him in the eye, it could penetrate the eye and get into the brain. But I don't know if a 25 caliber, a pellet from that. I want to say it shoots around 800, 900 feet per second, something like that. I'm just not sure if that would be lethal or not. Just with the size, the mass of the pellet. I don't know the answer to that question. Certainly lethal for small game. But anyway, so back to my email. So before I get there, this is where I took my little side trip here. Back in 2010, 2011, it was illegal for a felon to possess air guns in Minnesota. That actually changed. There was a Minnesota Supreme Court case called State of Minnesota versus David Lee Haywood. And this was back in 2016, where the Minnesota Supreme Court ruled that a BB gun was not a firearm. And that was a change to established case law in Minnesota. So again, when I first got this email from this person, I hadn't researched it in a while. And then I thought, well, I'm just going to research to make sure I'm not talking out of my you-know-what. And so I went and looked up to make sure that Minnesota, because I was going to tell this person that in Minnesota, it still is illegal for a felon to possess an air gun. And then I found out that changed. That's just something interesting that, again, tells you when you've been in the movement for a while, when things are different than something that you had thought and committed to memory as part of the gun landscape in your memory, it is no longer the case. In fact, excuse me for 1 minute. I have to write one more note because I forgot to, I just had another topic I was going to talk about tonight and I hadn't written in my notes. I had to jot it down in the other room, so I wanted to write that down before we got to it, and I forgot. Okay, so back to this email that I wrote to this individual. Some states, like Minnesota, used to prohibit felons from possessing air guns, but even that changed in 2016. See Minnesota Supreme Court case, State of Minnesota versus David Lee Haywood. An air gun could be considered a dangerous weapon, but there is no blanket statutory prohibition on dangerous weapons for felons in Wisconsin. And I put in parentheses, conditions of bail or probation, perhaps there could be, but not for a felon who has completed their sentence. And again, when I say there could be, I don't know that, but I believe when it comes to bail that the judge can set all kinds of conditions. Don't have contact with this particular person. Don't possess firearms. Don't drink alcohol. I mean, I think there's any number of conditions I think that they can put on jail. So perhaps as a condition of jail, or excuse me, bail, as a condition of bail, they might be able to say you can't possess an air gun, can't possess a knife, can't possess. I mean, I don't know. I've seen conditions of bail that you can't use the internet, or, you know, all kinds of things for child molesters, you know, can't use the internet, can't go near elementary schools or something. But a few additional thoughts. This is, again, my email back to this individual who posed this question. For felons who want to carry for self-defense, they should be aware that 90% of the time, according to FBI statistics, a gun that was used in self-defense was not discharged. Meaning when someone was threatened, they pulled a gun, drew a gun in self-defense, and the assailant was deterred and ran away / was no longer a threat. For that reason, someone who wants to carry an air gun for self-defense may want to consider an air gun that looks very close to a firearm. Some air guns are replicas of popular handguns. And so I bring this up because I went to the Byrna website when this individual sent me this email to begin with, and I thought, oh, that's a kind of a cool looking concept. What the Byrna is it's an air gun that shoots, they have two different kinds of projectiles. One is called kinetic, which is essentially just rubberized pellets that I think have a heavy mass lead BB in the middle of them, so they don't penetrate the skin. But then they also shoot, this isn't necessarily, I think, an accurate term, but exploding pepper balls. I don't know if exploding is really the right term. The pepper balls that burst on impact, and they're filled with a powder. They're filled with a pepper powder that would is essentially like, and that's one of the problems. Like when people talk about pepper spray and mace and all that stuff, is using it for self-defense purposes, you're projecting it from essentially your hand. And as soon as the propellant, as soon as the liquid leaves the nozzle of the aerosol can that you're holding, whether it be wind, whether it be contact with any number of things, an assailant's hand, that could redirect that chemical irritant back into your face. And in a self-defense situation, about the last thing that I would want is to not be able to freaking see. That would make self-defense extremely difficult to undertake if you couldn't see. And for that reason, one of the things, you know, pro-gun folks do tend to be pretty pessimistic, pretty pejorative with regard to carrying pepper spray for self-defense. And it's for pretty good reason, I think. I also sense a pessimism from pro-gun folks about less than lethal means of self-defense. And I want to talk about that in a little bit later in this topic. But back to this Byrna. So I go to the website, see this picture of this Byrna, and I thought it was a cool looking concept because unlike the handheld chemical self-defense, certainly then you'd have to be relatively close to your attacker. Your assailant would have to be relatively close for those to be effective. And then with the assailant being close and the propellant coming as soon as it's out of the nozzle of whether it's a can of pepper spray or bear spray or whatever you're using, then there's the potential that it's going to get in your eyes and make self-defense even more difficult versus make self-defense more practicable, more effective. But this Byrna air gun that launches these pepper balls, they don't, you know, you can hold the pepper balls in your hand. They don't become chemical irritants until they hit their target. Once they hit their target, they burst and there's a powdery cloud of this chemical irritant. And that's a pretty cool thing because the effective range, I believe they advertise in these is 60 feet, and 60 feet is a very good effective range for self-defense. certainly not an effective range for defense of others. You might be in a crowded, say a crowded theater in Colorado watching, was it Batman Returns or whatever, watching the Joker movie. I can't remember which it was. And you might want to act in defense of others from well across the theater, which could be perhaps more than 60 feet. Although that said, I think in most situations you would be 60 feet. I mean, Tueller drill, they say that's 21 feet and in is where a threat example with a knife is considered a deadly threat due to the proximity and the time it would take to get to you versus the time it would take to draw your gun, so on and so forth. So anyway, I do think that that's kind of a cool concept. This burn a gun where you could launch a pepper ball or launch a plastic ball that doesn't become activated as a chemical irritant until it bursts upon hitting its target from, again, 60 feet away. And what immediately came to my head was thinking about its utility for riots. But let me finish my email that I sent back to this person, and we'll take these other ideas and run with them a little bit in a second. So I went on to say that if someone – so, again, I looked at the Burna. One of the Burnas was like they have orange. They have a kind of that fluorescent green, I believe. And I thought if I was to recommend, I would suggest to a person that if they're going to get a Burna, they should probably go with the black one because it resembles very closely an actual firearm versus an orange one where an assailant might think, oh, that's not a real gun. I believe even though the Burna isn't a real gun, even though the chemical irritant in and of itself would be very effective in many situations to deliver you from harm's way, allow you to escape, so on and so forth, I would want a gun that's going to deter. I think a less than lethal, a less than lethal weapon, I think doesn't provide, not I think, I mean, certainly wouldn't provide the deterrent factor that a lethal weapon would. If someone pulls a gun on you and you realize that it's a fake gun, not a fake gun, you realize it's not a real firearm, not that you'd necessarily be able to identify, oh, that's a Burna. But let's say you did. Let's say, you know, these become a common thing and people recognize what a Burna is. If people have never, I've personally never experienced, well, side story here. I was going to say I've never experienced pepper spray. I've actually experienced pepper spray once. Should I tell this story? It's a good story. I'll tell it. Real quick. I was dating a girl. We were cleaning out her car. She had a pepper spray can, a little tiny keychain pepper spray thing in her car. I picked it up, said, oh, what's this? She said, oh, it's pepper spray. I sprayed a little bit on my finger, touched it to my tongue. I said, oh, is it poisonous? She said, no, it's not poisonous. She just touched it to my tongue, and holy shit, like it burnt the little spot of my tongue that I touched with my finger with that had been sprayed with pepper spray, like burned for, like, I'm not kidding, 20 minutes. I was like, holy shit. So, excuse me. So then I wipe my fingers off in the grass. I go for a walk with my girlfriend. We went for a walk out by Delavan Lake, details that aren't really important. And then, let's just say that later in the day, my girlfriend and I decided we were going to do things that boys and girls do. And so I don't want to get too graphic on the show here. So I began doing foreplay and foreplay. See, I really don't want to get too graphic because it's not that kind of show, but multiple different kinds of foreplay. This will make sense in a minute. And all of a sudden I said to her, I don't want to say her name. I said, so-and-so, I was like, did you like forget to wipe when you peed or something? Cause my mouth is like on fire. And she's like, no, I wiped. She's like, it's funny you say that because my crotch is on fire. And then at the same moment, her and I both realized the pepper spray. Like an hour earlier, I had sprayed the pepper spray on my finger, touched it to my tongue to sample it out, and then just wiped my fingers off in the grass. And actually, it never actually washed my fingers off. So the pepper spray residue was still on my fingers. And of course, my fingers got in contact with her crotch. Then this is really too graphic. Then my face got in contact with her crotch, and then my face was burning and her crotch was burning. So when I just said I've never had an experience with pepper spray, I lied. I realized I have had an experience with pepper spray. That aside, I've never had pepper spray in my eyes. So I don't have a good sense of, you know, some people have, I think people that have been through basic training, I believe they hit you with chemical irritants so you can experience what that's like. I've never been in the military, haven't served, haven't been through basic training, haven't experienced that kind of thing. So for me, I have very little, and I think there's probably a lot of other people who've never been pepper sprayed, never experienced how bad that could be. And some people might think, you know, if you're a professional rider like these BLM people, you probably experience tear gas and pepper spray and all that kind of thing. But I think for other people, you might not realize how truly, I mean, okay, it makes your eyes water and it makes you cough. You know, how bad could it be? And then you have it happen. You're like, holy shit, it's really bad. But I think for people who haven't experienced it, if you saw someone and they realized that it was just a pepper ball gun, in the same way that if you saw someone pull out a can of pepper spray and you've never been pepper sprayed, it might not be a deterrent because you might figure, oh, it's going to burn my eyes a little bit, but it's not going to disable me. It's not going to put me out of commission. And then I realize that it actually can be so irritating that it can put you out of commission for, you know, quite a period of time, whatever, 20 minutes, half hour, you need to rinse, you need to, all those kinds of things. So anyway, I just think that a less than lethal firearm would be a more effective self-defense tool if your assailant believed that it was a real firearm. Because again, it's documented with statistics that 90%+ of the time, a gun doesn't have to be discharged in self-defense. It merely has to be pulled in self-defense to be effective. So again, I would recommend if someone was looking at a Byrna, I would recommend the black version, not the orange one. The black version more closely resembles a traditional semi-automatic handgun and would have a greater deterrent value, in my opinion. If an assailant wasn't deterred by the sight of a gun pointed at them, then certainly discharging the air gun with the pepper chemical irritant is still an option. But as I share with our membership, I'm back to reading this email that I sent this person. It's always nice to deter a threat without having to discharge your weapon. And then there's one caveat to be aware of, and this is back to my email to this individual. Wisconsin does have a statute that makes it unlawful to use or display a facsimile firearm in a manner that could reasonably be expected to alarm, intimidate, threaten, or terrify another person. So this is a kind of interesting statute to be aware of in Wisconsin, this facsimile firearm statute. So what a facsimile firearm is essentially you put your hand in your pocket like you've got a gun. And that, like, this is like the old 70s and 80s television shows, maybe more, or maybe even movies at that time, where someone would stick their gun or stick their hand in the pocket of their coat, their jacket, and then order someone to whatever, drive the getaway car, you know, open the cash register, any kind. That's a facsimile firearm. Another facsimile firearm would be using a BB gun to commit an armed robbery. If it looks like a real gun, you can be charged for that, for using that facsimile firearm. And again, I cited the statute for this individual. Now, a firearm, a real firearm, this came up back during the open carry days before Act 35 here in Wisconsin, because some people thought that in order to preserve themselves, we knew that open carry was legal, but we also knew that many police departments didn't know that open carry was legal. This is back in 2010. Again, this is, now I'm taking it aside from this email that I wrote to this individual. So many people said, well, how about if we carried a replica BB gun instead? That way it appears like we're open carrying, but if the police actually stop and arrest us, we can say, hey, it's not actually a firearm. And that was proposed sometimes when we were thinking about doing open carry rallies and stuff. Again, this was all back before before Act 35 and also before J.B. Van Hollen came out with his famous advisory memo that said that open carry, absent any other circumstances, in and of itself was not disorderly conduct, which really opened the floodgates to open carry in Wisconsin. But prior to that, we had been talking about doing some open carry rallies and that kind of thing. And that was one of the discussions. Hey, what if we open carried replica BB guns in holsters That way, if they actually did try to arrest us for carrying a firearm, we could say, look, it's not a firearm. But then there's this Wisconsin statute that makes it unlawful to use or display a facsimile firearm in a manner that could reasonably be expected to alarm, intimidate, threaten, or terrify another person. Now, at the time when open carry was new, I think a prosecutor could make the case that open carrying something that looked like a real gun could reasonably be expected to alarm people, could reasonably be expected to intimidate people, could reasonably expected to threaten people, could reasonably expected to terrify people. Again, terrify might even be too strong, but alarm. I mean, there was people who were alarmed by open carry. Not a lot of them. Usually it was just the police overreacting. But there were certainly people who occasionally, you know, saw someone open carrying and they were alarmed enough to call the police. Usually it was a non-emergency number, but there was probably a few who called actual 911. So that you could say is alarmed. And I think a prosecutor could probably make a case that that's carrying a gun openly might reasonably be expected to alarm people in some situations. So anyway, this facsimile firearm statute, a firearm is exempt from the facsimile firearm statute. So a real firearm, if you open carry a real firearm, that might alarm, intimidate, threaten, or terrify another person, but it's exempt from the facsimile firearm statute. You have a right to carry. So it doesn't matter that someone might be alarmed, intimidated, threatened, or terrified by you open carrying a real gun. A real gun, there is no prohibition against carrying a real gun. There is a prohibition against actually threatening someone with a real gun. So you point at them, you threaten them, you got a gun on your hip and say, I'm going to draw this gun and put a bullet in your temple. You know, that's obviously illegal behavior. But a firearm is exempt from the facsimile firearm statute. So back to my email to this individual. If a person were to, for that reason, a firearm is exempt from the facsimile firearm statute, but an air gun is not exempt from the facsimile firearm statute. For that reason, if a person were to choose to carry an air gun that resembles an actual firearm, my advice would be they should carry it concealed, not openly, and they should not produce or display it unless they were in a self-defense situation. Self-defense would provide an affirmative defense to the crime of trying to scare someone with a facsimile firearm. Stated differently, if you were acting in self-defense, you would be allowed to use a facsimile firearm to deter a threat against you. Sorry for such a long answer. Feel free to reply if you need any clarification. Carry on, Nick Clark, President, Chairman, Wisconsin Carry. So that was an email that I exchanged with this individual, and I thought that was a good conversation that people might be interested in because it dives into something that maybe we concealed carry people, open carry people who carry firearms haven't dove into before. It's just these less than lethal options. But then continuing the conversation on air guns, and I tried to have this conversation on the Wisconsin Carry MeWe page, and it didn't go so well, although I wasn't surprised by that. I thought to myself, how about a Byrna for a riot situation? Now, first off, these Byrnas, like, they're like $390, they're $400, $500, so they're like the price of an actual firearm. I personally would never carry less than lethal for self-defense. But I pose the question, what about having one accessible in your vehicle if you ever find yourself in like a flash riot situation like we've seen so many motorists find themselves in 2012? Or what in 2020? Or what about property defense? Like, let's say you have a riot situation where you could use less than lethal as a means to protect your property, your business. Because remember, you can't use deadly force to protect property. You can only use deadly force to protect your life. So you're standing on the roof of your car dealership in Kenosha. There's hundreds of looters around, maybe not on your property at this point, but they're standing near it. Some of them have projectiles in their hand. They look like they're ready to throw Molotov cocktails. Unfortunately, the law doesn't allow you to pick people off who are standing on the edge of your property getting ready to toss a Molotov cocktail. That probably isn't perceived as a threat to your life. Your property, yes, but you're not allowed to use deadly force to protect property. So what if you did have in the situation like that? What if you were protecting your property during a riot and you wanted to have a Byrna gun handy? They've got handguns and Byrna rifles. What if you wanted to have one handy so that when you've got 100 people on the perimeter of your property and they start encroaching, you could start tapping a couple with some pepper balls to try to deter them. Or the minute they do step on your property, boom, nail them with a pepper ball. Step 1 foot on your property, bam, pepper ball to the chest. And that could be a very effective deterrent when lethal isn't allowed. I wouldn't want to be walking around carrying a Byrna for self-defense on a day. It's not like as an everyday carry. But let's say in your vehicle, we've all seen the videos, the drone footage or the helicopter footage. Someone takes a wrong turn in Minneapolis or wherever, St. Louis, I forget where some of these others have occurred, Oklahoma City, take a wrong turn and you're in the middle of a Black Lives Matter rally / riot that's spilled onto the street. You have people surrounding your car. They're not necessarily a lethal threat at that. Using your gun for self-defense wouldn't be justified. Your options then are to sit there. I mean, you can't, in some states, I think have passed statutes that allow you to drive through a riot if you're threatened, if you're escaping. Don't quote me on that. Wisconsin doesn't, but it seems like I remember a few states that had at least introduced legislation like that. Oklahoma and Florida might come to mind, but nonetheless, your options then are to sit there and see what happens. I've always recommended, look, if you can't go forward, you can't go back. Obviously have your windows rolled up, your doors locked, get to the center of your vehicle where you're as far away from bursting glass as you can, draw your firearm, don't point it at anybody, but draw it and warn your attackers who might be pounding on your car with fists, get back, I have a gun, have 911 on the, have call back. Call 911, set the phone down on speakerphone so that you can talk to 911 while you're, defending yourself without yet having to try to deter this attack. But then if someone does breach your vehicle, they breach your window and they start reaching in your car, then you do what you have to do. Castle Doctrine would come into play there. Someone forcibly enters your vehicle. Castle Doctrine does apply inside of your vehicle in Wisconsin. And I'm not telling anybody to use their gun for self-defense. I'm telling you to make the decision that's best for you in that instant. But that's the best situation to put yourself in if you find yourself surrounded by a flash mob. You can't just start popping off. You can't just start popping off people who are near you in an example like these mob type situations. If you had was a lethal means of self-defense, your options are stick the car in park, get 911 on speakerphone, windows up, doors locked, draw your gun, verbally threaten people to stay away. Don't point the gun at anybody until they breach your vehicle and then they start to make access, then boom. Then if that's a decision that you feel like making, again, I'm not telling anybody what to do, but that's a decision that you have to make in that instance if you feel like your life is in jeopardy. But now you've got a Byrna in your car. You start, you end up take a wrong turn. You're starting to get surrounded by a mob. Maybe that's an option. Maybe you could pull the Byrna gun out and there's a couple people in front of you initially, shoot them with the Byrna. And then maybe that gives you enough deterrence, enough to be able to drive around them before that. Because if one person is standing in front of your vehicle and you can't get around them, that gives time for the mob to surround you. But if you shoot them with a pepper ball and they are stumbling away, rubbing their eyes and coughing, that might clear a path for you to escape. So I think it might be an option. So again, I would never carry less than lethal for self-defense, but having one accessible in my vehicle, having one on hand, if I'm protecting a business or my home during a riot situation, it seems like a viable thing. So, I've only got Lon here in the chat, but I'm kind of curious what you guys think. People who are listening podcast later, I'm curious what you guys think for self-defense. Do you think it's a viable part of a self-defense, property defense repertoire? But it's funny because I think there's a proclivity among gun advocates to eschew any notion of less than lethal. And I've sensed this before, kind of a knee-jerk reaction against them. It's not quite as vicious as the, anything less than a .45 caliber full-frame 1911 is not adequate for self-defense crowd, because we all know those guys, those gun snobs who, I would never carry a .22 for self-defense. I would never carry a, you know, a, 9mm, a 45. But I've sensed a knee-jerk reaction against less than lethal from gun owners. And part of it I understand. For example, like smart guns, there's a knee-jerk reaction against smart guns. And I've sensed that before and kind of had it for myself. You know, people create a smart gun and all the gun owners are like, oh, that's a... So part of the knee-jerk reaction against smart guns, I understand, because smart guns could be, and in some cases would be, a mechanism that the loony liberal left would use to justify outlawing traditional mechanical firearms. Some states have passed laws that when certain kinds of smart guns become commercially viable, that they would be required. Again, I researched that in the past. I can't remember what states those are. It's not Wisconsin, but I can't remember what states those are. But for that reason, there is some justified resistance to smart guns on any level, because once they are technically viable from a hardware standpoint, software standpoint, many people worry that they're going to be required. I'm still open to the possibility in some circumstances some people might want a smart gun. It might be a wise option. For example, let's say you like to have loaded guns accessible around your house, but you have a child so young that they can't be taught firearm safety. I'm thinking like 3 and under, and it varies by kid, but you know, my fiance, her daughter, I mean, now my daughters are 16, 18, and then her son's even older. So, but the youngest was 3.5 when I started dating her, and she was around loaded firearms from the minute my fiance and I started dating. I taught her guns, taught all the girls gun safety, taught them how to clear my guns, took them shooting so they could experience the power of firearms, so they knew that they were what they were capable of, take away the fascination with firearms. I did that all when they were very little. But then I had loaded guns around a 3.5-year-old. In rooms that I wasn't in, she could walk in the kitchen. There's a loaded gun in the kitchen. But she knew, just like there's sharp knives in the drawer, she didn't pick up a sharp knife in the drawer and start stabbing her brother. She wasn't going to pick up a firearm and point it at somebody. We taught them about that. So, but less than 3, again, I just don't think kids are old enough to perhaps grasp the concept. And there's toddlers who have crawled up. In fact, I know someone personally, a toddler who crawled up and got his service weapon out of an end table and shot and killed himself. So certainly young children can't be taught firearm safety. Again, I'm thinking 3 and under-ish, maybe a little older, 4 and under. So always having a gun on your hip, and there's people like, oh, my gun's always on my hip. I mean, come on. On your hip isn't an option when you're taking a shower. It's not an option when you're walking around your house in your underwear. It's not an option when you're cuddling on the couch watching a movie with your wife or you know, a date for people who aren't married. You know, Netflix and chilling with a date. You might want to have a loaded gun sitting on an end table, you know, sitting somewhere where a child could access it. And for that reason, a smart gun might be a wise gun for you, a smart gun that has to be, you know, within a foot of the smart watch that pairs up to it, you know, that kind of thing. So I'm not against smart guns in concept. I wouldn't want to rely on one completely. You know, we talk about electromagnetic pulse situations, nuclear weapons that would render things with microchips and stuff inoperable. There's something to be said for the simplicity and reliability of mechanical firearms. But I don't completely cast it off. But back to the notion, I do think there is a knee-jerk reaction from gun owners to eschew less than lethal. And it's so funny because I'm writing these notes but to talk about this topic, about this reaction from gun owners to poo-poo less than lethal means of self-defense, less than lethal firearms. And as I'm writing my show notes for this topic, which I was writing on Wednesday, I make a post on the Wisconsin Carry MeWe group asking the same question, what people think of these, of a burna for a riot situation, that kind of thing. And no sooner do I make the post, I'm making notes talking about the knee-jerk reaction from gun owners against less than lethal, and I'm using the example of, like I said earlier, anything less than a full-frame 45 1911 is inadequate from self-defense, and some dude on the Wisconsin Carry MeWe page says the same. He says, as far as the burna, this quote, this stuff is glorified hot sauce. I openly carry a well-holstered 1911 and 45 caliber, no worries. And I just thought it was funny because that within 2 minutes of me posting the topic and then writing in my notes here that a lot of gun owners seem to poo-poo these less than lethal means, but I think that they should be and could be considered as an effective option in your repertoire. Again, certainly not something I would rely on as my primary self-defense weapon, but think about it. If you're a convicted felon and you can't carry a firearm, then I certainly would think about carrying one for my primary self-defense mechanism. So, but it was so funny. No sooner had I said that than someone posted that, made that comment about poo-pooing the notion of, a pepper ball gun is glorified hot sauce, and openly carry a well-holstered 1911 and 45 caliber, no worries. it's too predictable. Gun owners are too predictable sometimes. So anyway, I think it's kind of a cool concept. Someone else did make a post on the MeWe page that I thought was interesting, where some people kind of got where I was going with it. They kind of thought that the pepper ball thing had some merit. Asked if anybody had a chance to shoot one, own one, test one. And, but yeah, a few people, liked the, they embraced the concept, that I had, been considering. And that was kind of, but it was difficult to have the conversation because too many people, were immediately poo-pooing. And there was another person on the MeWe group in the chat that said, what did this person say here? I got it here. Should I find myself in a flash riot? My vehicle is my first line of defense, followed by over 45 rounds of 9mm. If they're still coming after that, well, I did what I had to do, or I did what I could with what I had. A little internet bravado there. So, but yeah, one person posted something interesting. My friend Kevin from Kenosha. And we're actually going to talk about Kenosha in a minute here. He said, Wisconsin has very weak OC laws. And OC is, I forget what OC stands for, but that's not open carry. That's something chemical. But it's essentially laws regarding pepper spray and that kind of thing. You can't carry more than 2 ounces at a time, and it has to be 10% or less. Also has to be, a canister can't be in a gun like this, to which I posed the question. So a no-go in Wisconsin for pepper balls, does it matter if it's powder versus liquid? Because these balls that this thing shoots are powder, not liquid. And this person from Kenosha, my friend Kevin, said he doesn't know the answer to that. So maybe something else still to look into here is whether those would be, whether it's legal to carry. I don't know if you add up the volume of the pepper in, I think there are 8 shots, but would that be less than 2 ounces, 10% or less? I don't know if 10% or less means that's the concentration of the chemical irritant in the mixture or something. But anyway, just something that I thought was interesting. And as someone who owns just about every kind of gun there is, and except for select fire, which I'd love to have, and belt fed select fire. But I have, every caliber pistol, rifle, revolver, shotgun, double barrel shotgun, semi-automatic shotgun, double barrel semi-automatic shotgun. I got a DP12, AR-10s, AR-15, 50 caliber. I have crossbows. I have 2 crossbows, which I think are really cool. I just thought that a Byrna might be something fun to add into the repertoire as well. It was an interesting conversation on Facebook, and I thought I'd bring it up here on the show. This next thing, speaking of Kenosha, I mentioned my friend from Kenosha was commenting on chemical sprays. I found out today that Dominic Black from Kenosha, for those of you who don't know, don't recall, Dominic Black is the friend of Kyle Rittenhouse who purchased the firearm for Kyle, who was charged with a couple felonies for straw purchase, essentially, for purchasing the firearm for Kyle Rittenhouse. Interesting now, the firearm charge was dropped. A straw purchase is purchasing a firearm for someone who's not legally allowed to purchase it themselves. In Kyle Rittenhouse's case, the charges for possession of a firearm by a minor were dropped, by a person under 18 were dropped, because in Wisconsin the statutes allow that. Speaking of which, there is a bill that was recently introduced by a bunch of Democrats to change that, and I'll keep you guys posted on that on future shows. That was introduced last week. I think it goes nowhere, but you never know. There's often too many Republicans who are ready to sell out your gun rights, so I wouldn't take it as a firewall there in Madison just because we have a Republican majority in the Assembly and in the Senate. But so the firearm charges dropped against Kyle Rittenhouse, which some people speculated might be the one thing he could get convicted of. And then, of course, Kyle Rittenhouse was acquitted of all the other charges. But yet then here's his friend, Dominic Black, who still faces, I think, up to like 12 years in prison for buying the gun that Kyle used. Wouldn't it have been really shitty if the only person that goes to jail in the Rittenhouse situation ends up being Dominic Black, who bought the gun for Kyle Rittenhouse? Because Kyle was 17. I think there might have been a legal argument to make that he didn't provide that he bought the that Kyle gave him the money for the gun. That was pretty clear, but that Kyle never took possession of the gun. Of course, until Kyle, the gun was always stored in Wisconsin. So did he really buy the gun for Kyle, or did he buy it for himself? Kyle paid for it, and then it was essentially his until Kyle was legally allowed to own it, then they were going to transfer it to him. Maybe there was a legal case to be made, but either way, it was legal peril for Dominic Black, who seems like a nice kid. He recently accepted a plea deal. I believe tomorrow there's a plea deal that's going to be entered for Dominic Black. He's going to plead guilty to contributing to the delinquency of a minor and pay a $2,000 fine. Contributing to the delinquency of a minor is a misdemeanor. Won't affect his future gun rights, won't affect his, he's not going to go to jail for anything. Again, I believe it's just a $2,000 fine that's going to be imposed against Dominic Black. I was contacted by the Kenosha County Eye, the investigative news, investigative journalism website, who, again, Kevin Mathewson, who I mentioned a little bit earlier, talking about the open carry, or excuse me, the chemical spray laws in Wisconsin. He called me, he's the editor of that organization of that of Kenosha County Eye, of that news outlet, and he contacted me for a quote, and what I shared was really that I think it's a palatable plea. I think it's a palatable outcome. Dominic Black doesn't go to jail, doesn't have a felony conviction, doesn't affect his gun rights, does have to pay a $2,000 fine. It's a palatable outcome, but not a just outcome. It's something reasonable. I don't blame him for not wanting to go to trial and risk going to prison for 12 years or losing having a felony conviction, which would take away your right to keep and bear arms. So reasonable plea while not just. And I think the other quote that I left the Kenosha County Eye with was that it's really unfortunate that Wisconsin gun laws leave such a minefield, because Kyle and his friend Dominic Black were trying to do things within law. He could have just given the gun to Kyle. He could have bought the gun for Kyle and just given it to him and made the straw purchase outright. He didn't. They were trying to follow the law. And, again, it's just unfortunate that Wisconsin laws are such a minefield for them. So that's what's coming up tomorrow. Dominic Black is going to have that plea entered. I think just a judge has to accept it. Let's see. I've only got 6 minutes left in the show here. I was going to talk about, real quick, Ted Cruz. Did you see Ted Cruz going off last week? I was like, what the hell? Ted Cruz, on the anniversary of January 6th, and it drives me nuts when all the Republicans and all the conservative talk radio and everything has to make a big deal about January 6th, just like the mainstream media. It's letting the liberals dictate the topic du jour. And even though you're doing the topics on January 6th to refute the things that the liberals are saying, I think it just still does make it a big to-do, and I don't know. I'm more about playing offense versus defense, and it just seems like playing too much offense. But Ted Cruz was going on and on about how the January 6th was an act of terrorism. This was a terroristic attack. The people who committed this were terrorists. And I'm like, whoa, I'm hearing this on January 6th of this year. I'm like, Ted, what the fuck? I don't trust Ted Cruz. I was a Ted Cruz guy back in 2016 until Trump secured the nomination, but just Ted Cruz, I don't know. There's something about him that like, and it was this characterization of January 6th as playing into the Democrat talking points of calling it a terrorist attack was just, it's not the kind of thing I expect to hear about from a ball busting Republican, from a true conservative, from a Make America Great conservative. And it was disappointing to see from Ted Cruz. He's kind of walked it back and tried to apologize a little bit for it in the days following. I think a lot of people were kind of outraged by what Ted Cruz said, but still kind of doubled down in a way. So it wasn't really an apology. All right, I got 4 minutes left in the live broadcast. I actually might end up going a little bit over time because I've got one last topic I was going to hit here tonight. And it's the propaganda, the pandemic propaganda. You know, we've been hearing all summer long, ever since vaccines came out, that this is now a pandemic of the unvaccinated. And it's such bullshit. Last week, I did a segment about the shifting narrative and the propaganda now, that the old propaganda isn't holding true regarding COVID. We were told for half a year now that this was a pandemic of the vaccinated. But now the narrative has completely changed, and the new narrative is, here's a story in the Business Journal, and here's a quote from the story. This is about Advocate Aurora. Advocate Aurora clinical executives continue to attribute the spike in hospitalizations to three groups of patients, those who are unvaccinated. So now all this foofrah about this, all this dust up, all this sensational hysteria about the spike in hospitalizations, and hospitals are filling up, which hospitals aren't actually filling up. Hospitals are so understaffed, their available beds are filling up, but they have fewer available beds. Advocate Aurora Clinical Executives is a quote, continue to attribute the spike in hospitalizations to three groups of patients, those who are unvaccinated, those who received just one dose of a vaccination, or those who were due for a booster shot. The executive from Advocate Aurora said 92% of inpatients fall into those categories. So this is interesting because many times you can get to the truth from the media in what is not said. When you know how someone operates, when you know what someone's motivation is, when you know how the mainstream media operates, when you know what the mainstream media's motivation and objective is, what they don't say tells you what they are hiding. So first, by expressed admission, it's funny because the Advocate Aurora executives say that 92% of the people hospitalized were unvaccinated or undervaccinated. See, it used to be just unvaccinated. Now they've changed it to unvaccinated or due for a booster. You know, again, that was that changing narrative last week. Here we've got this citation that 92% of inpatients fall into this category of unvaccinated or unboosted. So I'm going to lose you here in about, I think in about a minute, Lon. So Lon, great to have you in live tonight. And if you want to catch the last part of this topic, it'll be on the podcast. Thanks so much for tuning in and have a great week there. But for you podcast listeners, this will be seamless. You'll just hear the end of this topic. So again, what is expressed in this quote from Advocate Aurora, and there's what's not expressed. So first, by expressed admission, 8% of the people who are hospitalized have had the COVID shot and have had the booster. So the previous lie that a COVID shot, and you know what, I'm not calling it a vaccination because that's an insult to vaccinations, but the lie that a Fauci COVID shot, I think that's going to be my new name for it, the Fauci COVID shot. The lie that a Fauci COVID shot will keep you out of the hospital is now exposed because 8% of the people hospitalized have had the COVID shot, the Fauci COVID shot, and they've had the booster and they're still in the hospital. So that's 8% of the people, almost 1 in 10 are people that are fully vaccinated, fully boosted. So that's not a pandemic of the unvaccinated. That's still 10% of the people are those. But second, what do you think the percentages are of the others? The other 92% of inpatients that they cite in this statistic, in this article, some of those did get both shots, the two-shot regimen, but they're due for a booster. Now, some only got one shot. I suspect if someone got the first shot, they probably went ahead and got the second, unless they had a reaction to the first one and couldn't get the second or something. But let me ask you something. If those hospitalized that had no shots, that were completely unvaccinated, or that didn't have the Fauci COVID shot at all, had never had any Fauci COVID shot, not even one, if those were like 80% of the hospitalizations, bet your ass that that would have been the headline. Bet your ass if 80% of the hospitalizations were completely un-Fauci COVID shotted, that would be the headline. But when they say 92% of the patients were unvaccinated or undervaccinated, not boosted, we can be virtually certain. I mean, we know the tactics of the propagandists here. We can be virtually certain that a huge percentage of those hospitalized did have both Fauci COVID shots. And we also know that they just changed the recommended booster time frame from to 5 months instead of 6 months. So now, you know, a week ago, someone was, quote, fully vaccinated by their definition. But immediately now that they've revised and that the booster is recommended a month sooner, millions of people now fall into that category of not boosted. And the recommendation keeps changing. See, well, that's another funny, and that's another interesting thing. You know, here they say in that quote, they say, due for a booster shot. I went to go look back at my notes and I lost my spot here. So they've changed the recommended booster interval to 5 years. So now in a 6 month period of time, if you don't have three shots, you're considered not fully vaccinated. And the recommendations keep changing because, again, a month ago, it was 6 months for a booster. Now it's 5 months. Now, I'm actually not convinced that these Fauci COVID shots do anything. COVID has always lightened up in the late spring and summer. And I think it may have been pure coincidence / the normal pattern for this virus that the number of cases fell right as the Fauci COVID shots started going into arms late last winter and spring. But most states, between 60 and 70% are, quote, vaccinated. Yet we have more COVID infections than we had when there were no COVID shots at all. More hospitalizations than we had no COVID, than when we had no COVID shots at all. So remember, initially they said that the Fauci COVID shots, the COVID vaccination, they said it prevented symptomatic infection in 95% of people. That was a lie. That's been totally proven false. People that have both shots are getting COVID all over the place. Even people who were boosted. Within people who had both shots and then a month later they were getting COVID. So that initial report that the COVID vaccine was 95% effective against symptomatic infection. That's an infection where you show outward symptoms, where you can tell that something's wrong. They said it was 95% effective. Bullshit. No way. That's totally proven false. Then they said it prevented hospitalizations. And now that's a lie. That's been proven false. And now they're resorting to shorter and shorter intervals between shots. But anyone who believes that that will do anything hasn't been paying a lick of attention. And I'll say it again. I'm now very open to the notion that the Fauci COVID shot does literally nothing to stop COVID. Maybe, and that's a big maybe it did something on the original primary strain. But just like the flu shot that we've had for, you know, decades here in this country, I think maybe viruses mutate so rapidly, weeks or a few months, that you just can't keep up with a mutation with a mass-produced vaccine. You can't produce an effective vaccine for a virus as fast as a virus will mutate, which is why I think there should be a focus on therapeutics. But the problem is there's no money in therapeutics. There's no money for big pharma if everybody takes ivermectin the minute they got a symptom, and then they end up not hospitalized and they don't need a vaccine. There's no money in therapeutics. And I don't think big pharma wants to cure anything anymore. I think curing stuff is small potatoes. I think big pharma wants lifelong dependency. I think big pharma wants lifelong customers. They cured polio with a vaccine. I don't think they want to do that anymore. I don't think that the money goes to curing things anymore. I think big pharma wants to treat things forever. I think big pharma wants golden gooses. And here's the thing. University, you would think that capitalism, like the profit motive, would provide an incentive for one company to cure things, but it doesn't, because the money is not in curing. The money is in perpetually treating. Big pharma wants to treat things forever. They want the golden gooses. Universities and research, I mean, universities and academic research, that's all funded by grants. Where do you think the grants come from? The people who write those grants direct the research. The big pharma funds those grants. Big pharma funds the research. They want research on things that treat a disease, not things that cure diseases. Hell, look at the new AIDS drugs now. You've seen the advertisements on TV that supposedly they say, this, I forget the name of the drug, it keeps you undetectable. And if you stay undetectable, you can't transmit the virus. That's what they say on these television commercials for these AIDS drugs. So look at these AIDS drugs that keep you undetectable. And if you stay undetectable, you can't transmit the virus. But guess what? You got to take the pill forever to stay undetectable. How wonderful for big pharma. You've got a customer for life. They haven't cured AIDS. They've just found a lifelong treatment for it. Think of what we might have cured by now if we had a health science industry / academia in this country that was trying to cure things or trying to prevent things, not trying to eternally treat things, but that's what we've got. We've got big pharma who's trying to eternally treat things. They want to treat things forever. So anyway, that's the show for tonight. That's everything I had. That's this shifting narrative of COVID. It's so, like, again, I'm not even convinced that the Fauci COVID shot does anything at all. Perhaps against the original strain it did, but I'm not so sure that it even does that. That against any of these new strains, Delta, Omicron, that the Fauci shot does anything, because it doesn't seem to prevent it. Well, it doesn't prevent infection. There's no indication that it prevents infection. There's no evidence that it prevents infection. There's no evidence that it There's growing evidence that it doesn't prevent hospitalizations. There's growing evidence that it doesn't prevent death. I mean, how could we have 60 to 70% of the country vaccinated and still have the highest numbers that we've had? That defies logic. I'm not saying that they used to say 70% was herd immunity. Again, I'm not saying that I would expect no COVID, but certainly not the worst outbreaks in the history of the pandemic. Something just doesn't add up with these Fauci COVID shots. So that's the show. Great to thank you guys for tuning in, wherever you're listening from, whatever you're doing. Feel free to shoot me an email. I love hearing from people. Nick@wisconsincarry.org. Wisconsin Carry, we're re-implementing our email. If you're a Wisconsin Carry member and you did not get an email from me, check the email that you used to use for Wisconsin Carry, 5, 6, 7 years ago, because I sent a mass email around last week. But we'll talk more about that in next week's show. Carry on. Have a great week. Be well armed.
This is Sniper Chick Julie. You've been listening to Well Armed Radio, and I have to know, is that a gun in your pants, or did you just really enjoy the show?
Stop listening to the bombastic loudmouths on the radio and television and the internet. To hell with them.